Welcome back. A text from Paula says, many of those who later became Australians, against their wishes, fought through the 6 months' warfare of the 98 Rebellion. Dublin revisionism has done a thorough job of burying this history along with the whole 98 Rebellion. Well, Paula, if you're listening to Drive Time in a couple of weeks, I will have an item on the United Irishmen of the 98 Rebellion in the On This Day slot. So have a go with that.
On Friday night, there were landed at Larne within a few hours 40,000 rifles and nearly 3.5 million rounds of ammunition. There was no rush or bustle. It was accomplished with celerity, yet without fuss or splutter, because it was done in pursuance of a well-formed plan. All the arms were landed at Larne Harbour, and a vast transport of hundreds of motor cars, lorries and wagons, drawn from their various centres, came to the town. It was an amazing sight to see this huge procession of cars, nearly 3 miles in length, descending upon the town with all their headlights ablaze. The people flocked to their doors as the seemingly endless procession filed past in the direction of the harbour.
Well, that piece was taken from the Belfast Telegraph of the 25th of April 1914. The newspaper was describing the events of the night of the 24th of April 1914, when up to 40,000 rifles and 3 million rounds of ammunition were smuggled from Germany into Larne in County Antrim. The operation was organised to equip the Ulster Volunteer Force formed the previous year. This week is the centenary of the Larne gun running, which was a central episode in the Unionist campaign at the time. Here to talk about it is Conor Mulva, lecturer in Irish history at University College Dublin, and their man who's looking after the decade of commemorations. And I'm also joined from Belfast by Dr. Timothy Bowman, senior lecturer in history at the University of Kent. You're both very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Tim, first of all, what was the background to the creation of this, let's call it an army in Ulster?
Well, this dates back really to January 1913, when the Ulster Volunteer Force had been formed. And of course, if we think about the creation of that, Unionists said that they had led a popular campaign against Home Rule that had been ignored. We think there particularly of the League and Covenant signing in September 1912. Unionists talked a lot about their parliamentary campaign and basically said that that had all been ignored by the Liberal government and its allies in the Irish Parliamentary Party. So that was the sort of Unionist narrative about why they were driven towards a military response, if indeed we can see it as a military response. And then from January 1913, there's a lot of ad hoc arming going on of local units, which it's questionable how illegal that is up until a declaration, Royal Proclamation, comes in December 1913, which then leads to this great plan to bring in a massive amount of guns in one lift, if you like, rather than the sort of few hundred that have been smuggled in on a rather ad hoc basis up to that point. There's also some concerns about UVF morale by the end of 1913, that men were getting fed up with endless drilling and endless route marches, and that if they weren't given arms soon, the momentum would fade within the Unionists. Campaign against Home Rule.
And one of the main instigators, Conor, in the Larne gun running was a fascinating character, a man called Major Frederick H. Crawford. This is somebody that I would have come across in the 1890s, and his interest, or the point of interest then, was that he was involved in a plot to kidnap William Gladstone.
Absolutely right, Miles. Frederick Crawford, I suppose, most remembered for his role in the Larne gun running, but before that point, Crawford was constantly involved in, I suppose, anti-democratic efforts in Ulster. And the first and the most notable of these was after his return from a life of seafaring of a year, he comes back and finds himself embroiled in the Home Rule crisis of 1893. And he approaches his senior Unionist figure and says, I'd like £10,000. And if you can fund me, I'll kidnap Prime Minister Gladstone. I'll take him to a remote Pacific island. I'll supply him with all the necessity he needs, including a full classics library.
And
I'll keep him out of politics until the Home Rule question can be settled. So Crawford never had much of a regard for democratic processes. Famously, he seems to be the only example they can find in the Solemn League and Covenant who signed in his own blood. And there's actually the pen that he signed in is on Prony's website. They have that, and I've actually tweeted today the picture of his signature. It's in black and white, so it's hard to tell whether it's in blood or not. But Crawford was most certainly a figure who was constantly involved in, I suppose, this derring-do, gung-ho attitude to politics and being able to undermine the democratic process through arms.
Tim, is that a myth? Did he actually sign it in his own blood? Do we know?
I thought that there had been a DNA test which showed that the record of Prony isn't signed in blood. But of course, when those people signed the covenant, they got a parchment to take home with them. So it's quite likely that he signed that in blood and then that was framed and kept above the mantelpiece, something of that nature.
OK, well, we get the idea. We get the picture about Frederick H. Crawford, I think, at this stage, one way or the other. Tim, how did the Germans end up supplying this pretty massive shipment of guns and ammunition? 40,000 rifles, 3,000 million rounds of ammunition. This was well before the outbreak of World War One.
Yes, well, we can talk about the numbers, of course. What you've got from the Belfast Telegraph is unionist propaganda at its finest. I reckon it was closer to 20,000 rifles that they brought in. And, of course, European armies had undergone enormous change with rifles over the course of the 19th century. So a lot of what the UVF purchased, and we should make it clear it's a straight cash deal, it's not a gift from the German government. A lot of what the UVF buy are basically obsolete rifles. This is stuff that had been discarded by the German army.
These are not Lee Enfields.
No, they're largely Mausers, German rifles, Sturs, which were Austrian, and the real bargain basement stuff was Italian Vittorelli rifles that had been withdrawn from service with the Italian army about 1884. And you know, your knowledge of military history probably leads you to believe that the Italian army wouldn't quite have been at the cutting edge of weapons technology at any point in the 19th century. So some of this stuff is really fairly poor quality, and that sort of throws up the question about, is it really for propaganda purposes rather than for military purposes that so much of it's being brought in?
How, Connor, did they manage to give the slip to the authorities, who were fairly well informed on their activities?
This is where the question of state complicity comes in. I suppose in talking about this, one person who shouldn't go without mention today when we remember the Larne gunrunning is the one fatality of the entire incident. Mm. And that was a Coast Guard named H.E. Painter, who cycled with such gusto to inform his commander that guns were being landed at Donaghadee that he had a heart attack and died on the night. So there was one fatality during the Larne gunrunning. But in general, there had to be a degree, particularly of police complicity, with this entire process, because cordons were set up around the Antrim coast from 8 p.m. onwards on the night of the 24th. Interestingly, it wasn't done with perhaps the military precision, and here I go back to Tim's point about propaganda at its best. This was something which was heralded as a great propaganda move. For instance, the Clyde Valley, the ship that actually landed at the various ports, was renamed for the night the Mountjoy 2, remembering the ship the Mountjoy which had broken the siege of Derry. So there was history and propaganda being mixed in together. But the schedule that was planned for a full nighttime landing where this would outfox the authorities and anyone who was trying to move against them. But the last arms weren't landed until 8:30 in the morning on the 25th of April, much later than had originally been planned. So they were landed in full daylight. And what we have to contrast here is the actions of the Ulster Volunteers in April and the actions of the Irish Volunteers in July of 1914, because the Howth gunrunning, in many senses, is the poor man's emulation of what happens in Larne in April of 1914. At Howth, a much smaller consignment of roughly 1,500 rifles is landed, and that's done in broad daylight. So despite the fact that they don't have the financial backing that the Unionists have in April of 1914, they try to provoke a military response, and that's exactly what happens in Dublin.
Fascinating text here, Tim. According to the late Professor Tony Stewart, A.T.K. Stewart, in the Ulster Crisis, the best armed branch of the UVF before the Larne gun running of April 1914 was, wait for it, the County Donegal UVF.
Yes, there are different stories about this. There is talk that Lord Leitrim brings in a consignment in his private yacht, and that this provides a lot for the Derry and the Donegal battalions, who I don't think get anything directly out of the cash that's brought in Larne, because supposedly the furthest unit that has to travel from Larne is the Tyrone UVF, the cars bringing guns to them on the night of the 24th, 25th.
Who, Connor, who was the Captain Wilfred Spender? He was one of the key figures in the operation. What exactly did he do?
Spender at this point is the Quartermaster General of the UVF. Like all those involved at the most senior levels, he's a retired British Army officer. Famously, he's the one British Army officer who's singled out by Lord French in December of 1913 that he might be cashiered out of the British Army. He'd lose his commission as an example to the rest of those who were siding with Ulster and openly, I suppose, providing support support to the Ulster Unionists. So he's identified early on as being one of those key troublemakers within Ulster. He's one particularly important person in terms of his role as Quartermaster General. He organises this distribution. And as much as I downgraded the efficacy of the landing at the ports, the actual distribution through motor cars was much more efficient. And that was done with great speed throughout the province of Ulster. Just to go back to one point Tim made, it's very important to note here that all Ulster volunteers weren't created equal in the sense of where the arms went. And the lesser efficient rifles, the Italian rifles, etc., were sent to the border counties. And the best rifles were kept in Belfast itself, which underlines a key point about how the UVF operated and how certain hierarchies on a regional level happened.
Tom texts us to say it's rarely mentioned, but it's thought that some of the weapons from the Larne gun running made their way to Loyalist allies in Dublin, namely the Loyal Dublin Volunteers, who had their headquarters in Parnell Square. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe some of the weapons were accidentally unearthed by workmen in the 1930s. I'm not sure if anybody can cast any light on that one.
No, very, very shadowy organisation, the Loyal Dublin Volunteers. We don't really have the Dublin Metropolitan Police records for the period, so without them, we're rather in the dark. Some newspaper accounts, again, unionist ones, talk about them being 3,000 strong and going on parade with arms. So it may well have happened, but we're not exactly sure.
But I think, Tim, some of the Larne guns did re-emerge during the Troubles at some point, didn't they? Routine searches of weapons conducted by the British Army.
Yes, a number turn up during the Troubles. But most of them, of course, we should say, end up being taken over by the British government in 1818 so that they don't fall into the hands of the IRA. There's a lot of concern about that at the time. And most of them end up essentially being melted down in 1841 to provide high-grade rifle steel for modern rifles.
Did the gun running have any real military significance? Or do you think, I mean, to go back to what you were saying about the numbers of rifles, Tim, was it more a symbolic show of strength by the UVF? What do you think? Well, where's the truth there?
Well, I think it's rather difficult to work out what exactly is going on within the Ulster Volunteer Force. There's certainly hawks and doves. We've talked quite a bit about Crawford there, who's obviously a hawk within all this. But there's plenty of doves. Somebody like Richardson, the supposed general officer commanding the UVF, is a dove. And Carson himself, you know, backs the gun running, but then later on makes some interesting comments about it. So when he's talking to the Central Antrim Regiment at a big parade in Larne on the 11th of July 1914, he says that the lessons they must take from Larne are discipline and confidence in their leaders, that this isn't a military solution. And he goes on to say that they have not been organised and trained for the purpose of fighting their fellow citizens, that it's not against them that they've been organised. So again, we come back to this issue about whether it's a propaganda force or a military force. I think some of the rank and file certainly were throwing up sort of military scenarios as they saw it, and sort of heroic last stands in County Cavan. There's a few speeches along those lines. But I think for Carson, it's all about a parliamentary campaign, and that really the Ulster Volunteer Force is acting in support of that.
Conor, what was the nationalist response to the Larne gun running?
This is, I suppose, a great crisis for nationalist Ireland. And what we see here is an absolutely exponential expansion in the numbers of Irish volunteers. There are two twin crises here. This isn't an isolated incident, in that the Curragh Mutiny, which we discussed on the programme last month, was, I suppose, the counterpoint of this. There was no longer any confidence in the British military to impose the rule of law in Ulster, and now the Ulster Unionists themselves were armed. So the volunteers, first of all, swelled their ranks, and nationalists realised that there's a genuine danger of an ethnic war in Ireland. And I suppose this brings Ireland closer to civil war. And then secondly, the nationalists begin to arm themselves. And it's in the months of April that people like Erskine Childers begin to make contact, just like Crawford himself had done, with arms dealers in Germany.
Conor Mulva and Timothy Bowman, thank you very much indeed for your company and your contribution.